and welcome to this episode of The Broadcast with me, your host, David Brooks, and my co-host, Simon Q. This time, we are joined by Jerry Moriarty, CEO of the Irish Association of Pension Funds and also the chairperson of Pensions Europe. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Thanks for coming along. So I think one of the first things I think would be interesting for our listeners to understand, given your position over the water in Ireland, is what is, in a couple of minutes, sort of the Irish pensions landscape currently looking like? You know, we're all used to familiar with sort of the three pillars of pensions, you know, sort of state pensions, private savings and occupational type benefits. But how does the Irish landscape look at the moment?
I suppose in many ways it's sort of similar in structure to the UK, or certainly to what the UK would have looked like maybe 10 years ago pre-auto enrollment. We have a, you know, first pillar state pension that's actually a fixed amount. So everybody gets the same once you have sufficient social insurance contributions built up over your working lifetime. We have a voluntary second pillar system. So that means only about 50% of the workforce have any pension savings. And that's something we're trying to fix with auto-enrollment, which we're going through a long, slow process of introducing, but is finally getting closer. And then for people who want to save additionally, you've got your personal pension type third pillar pensions. We've also seen in recent times a sort of significant move to master trust. So, you know, we've always had this thing about having more pension schemes than the rest of Europe. I think partly because our regulator chose to register and count them. But having applied a lot of the new IRP2 pension provisions for the last European Pensions Directive to all pension schemes, that's really forced smaller schemes to move to master trust because the additional cost they would have to incur is just so high, it's just not feasible to continue in a standalone basis. Our DB schemes are to a large extent at this point in time closed to new entrants, other than maybe a few, but they still form a big portion of the market because the bulk of assets, well, just about the bulk of assets are still in DB plans. Haven't really had much of the sort of move to buy out or buy in as there's been in the UK, and maybe some specific reasons for that, but probably something those schemes are starting to look at it, as well as more and more of their membership is taken up from people who used to be employed with the company rather than currently employed. And if you're spending a lot of time and money on that, it causes management to think a little bit about, is there an alternative?
And Jerry, just to give our listeners an idea of the scale of the number of schemes in Ireland, it's somewhere around about 75,000, isn't it?
It depends who counts. but yeah, if you take that 70,000, which were sort of live schemes with contributions being paid, but over 65,000 of those only had one member in it. So there was a distinct tax advantage to set up a scheme under trust and to set up a personal pension plan, particularly around how employer contributions were treated. So for our kind of mainstay personal pension plan, which is personal retirement savings account, PRSA, your employer and then employee contributions are counted the same and counted for revenue limits. So until recently, that meant there was a huge advantage for company directors, particularly to set up a trust where there was, you know, just a lifetime limit on employer contributions. So that's got fixed recently, but that would have sorted a lot of that problem out. So, you know, in the UK, the pensions regulator, by my understanding is, doesn't look at one member arrangements. So, you know, the fact that, you know, we had so many was, like I said, because the regulator chose to count them and look at them. So, you know, that problem has now largely been fixed by the moves to Master Trust and by fixing that tax issue as well.
And you touched on the launch of auto-enrollment. It'd be interesting to hear about how that journey has been and how long you've been on that journey. Obviously, we in the UK, we've had that in place for 12 years, and we can probably discuss whether we think that's been a success or a failure. But it'd be interesting to, you know, how was the genesis? Was it, you know, you can see it working in inverted commas in the UK and think, well, we want to get that 50% number up as well that you mentioned. There's probably quite a few drivers to why it's happened.
Yeah, I think the UK experience has given it a lot more impetus in recent years. So we probably first started looking at auto-enrollment certainly seriously over 20 years ago. I actually worked with the regulator at the time, and you know, we did a couple of reports at the time around how it could be introduced. I think for political reasons it was decided not to at the time, because, and I think, you know, one thing I've probably learned from the UK is, you know, there's never a perfect time to introduce it. Sometimes you just have to get on and do it. So initially, back when we had a really vibrant economy, there was a concern that introducing it might upset that. Then you go into recession, and that's clearly the wrong time to do it. Now you're back in a vibrant economy. I think what has changed, and particularly with our Department of Finance, or our equivalent of Treasury, have started looking a lot more at the long-term implications of demographic change and what that might do to, if you like, calls on state to fund, particularly if a lot of people don't have retirement savings. You're dealing with people who are maybe less likely to own property by the time they come to retirement, or certainly if they do own, they may not have paid for it at that stage. So I think it's that long-term demographic trend has sort of changed the mindset of government officials particularly, and then experience of countries like the UK as well, where, you know, it's certainly been very successful in doing what I set out to achieve, which is increasing pensions coverage. But, you know, it's kind of separate conversation around adequacy, but certainly from that aspect, I think it's given a lot more impetus. So, you know, we're now at a stage where we're kind of moving forward. So I prefer if it moves a bit quicker, but, you know, we are getting towards that stage where within the next 2 years, certainly, I think we will have auto enrollment in place.
And just, you know, I'm not very familiar with the rules. And so in the UK, we have these, as I'm sure you're aware, you know, you have qualifying earnings and then banded earnings. And the whole principle behind auto enrollment when it was introduced in the UK was to help median low-income workers save more, but then you have that whole trade-off between saving for a what will be a small pension, which is being offset against money now to pay off debts, and I, as you know, allude to, you know, getting on the property ladder, and, you know, but we've got that problem now of people coming or will be coming to retirement in the next 10-20 years with debts, with a mortgage, and a small pension. Has that been something that the Irish regulator and government been thinking about when setting this up?
Yeah, I think they've been quite conscious of that in the design. So, you know, it's focused as well as coverage on adequacy. So, you know, the rules will be, and it's actually just going through Parliament. There's a parliamentary committee meeting this afternoon. So I don't imagine they change that much, but everybody over the age of 23 earning over 20,000 a year will be auto-enrolled who's not currently in an employer's pension scheme. Contributions will start at 1.5% of full earnings, so total earnings, overtime, shift work, bonuses, from the employee, 1.5% from the employer and 0.5% from the state as a direct contribution instead of tax relief. And then every 3 years it will rise by the same amount, so that by year 10, the total contribution rate will be 6% from employees, 6% for the employer, and 2% for the state. So you will have 14% of total earnings up to 80,000 a year. So I think for most people, particularly people who start younger in their careers, that will give you a decent pension in retirement.
Yeah, what I've found interesting over the years, because I've been over in, Jerry knows this, I've been over in Ireland quite a bit over the years, not just there for drinking Guinness, although I've done a fair bit of that as well. But in
that's all I've ever seen, Simon.
This is the new Simon you're seeing today. This is very strange, isn't it?
Yeah, a sensible Simon. But we've spoken a lot about how the UK might help Ireland, and it's certainly not telling Ireland what to do, because that's not the way to go about it. But it's sort of the way I've always positioned it was learn from our mistakes. So we had a massive growth in master trusts. I think it was 91 we got up to, I think was a number. And the regulator said, well, we'd only want about 8. And we're nowhere near that number now either. But one thing I was saying when I was in Ireland to authority, government, whoever would listen, was don't make the mistake we made there and let it blow up and then have to row it back. And the contribution point is something where we're having a real problem in the UK at the moment, is people are simply not paying enough in. And your point there, Jerry, of going up to 14% ultimately. We're not there. And I think in the UK, we need to be. So this is something we need to learn from Ireland.
Yeah, I think in fairness, in the design of the system, the various department officials did go and visit a lot of countries. They had a lot of input. They, I think, actually had some funding from the European Union. So they had some people working with them who are familiar with other systems, particularly some of the Scandinavian ones. And, you know, doing something later does give you that advantage of sort of picking and choosing the things that work, as well as then having to align for what you think works for your own country as well, because that's always going to be different. I think the key learnings from the UK, the adequacy is one piece. I do worry about, you know, it's taken us so long to get to the starting point in auto-enrollment and then having these stepped contributions. You know, Australia was very slow in moving from in getting eventually to where they were meant to get to. It, again, it comes back to the, well, there's always a, it's either a recession or you don't want to disturb an economy that's doing really well. But I think if we're disciplined in putting those increases in place, that gets you to a good place. I think probably the other big learning point from the UK, which we've decided to do differently, and again, there are different views about this because some of the consequences probably lead to the delay, is that the focus is going to be on enrolling employees, not getting employers to enroll employees. So we're setting up a sort of central authority that is going to basically trawl through revenue data, identify people who meet the eligibility criteria, who meet the earnings criteria, and then just notify their employers that they're being enrolled, that they need to deduct contributions, pay them across to the authority, which will then do all the admin processing and hire the investment managers and invest the money with them. So that takes away a lot of the issues I think you have in the UK with a lot of employers really struggling to get employees on board. And more importantly, what it's really designed to do is that if an employee then moves on to another employer, nothing changes in their pension. You know, the contributions are coming from a different source, but they're going to the same place. So you end up with somebody who doesn't have lots of different pots over their career, unless they move to an employer who has an existing scheme. But that's but that does mean all that infrastructure has to be built and put in place, and that's been one of the reasons why it's been slow. So
so you're doing the lifetime provider model that we were talking
about? Exactly, yes. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. I feel like I should have known that. This has been such a hot topic of the last 6 months in the UK. We've been turning ourselves inside out, arguing amongst ourselves like rats in a bag about lifetime provider model. We didn't realise that you guys were doing that as your central, wow.
Yeah, and I think it was, I mean, in fairness, it's not just the UK. I think there would have been the Australian experience as well, yeah, where you had millions and millions of unclaimed accounts. So it's trying to prevent that. So, you know, that's the logic behind. Now, that does mean you're sort of bypassing the existing infrastructure that's in place. So all this has to be built from scratch. And, you know, we're still at the stage where the administrator hasn't been appointed. They probably will be in the next few weeks. They need to start building the system. It's working on a different basis to the rest of the system because there's no tax relief involved. It's a direct government contribution. So that's going to take time. So officially, you know, government is saying we'll be starting on the 1st of January next year. In reality, it's very hard to see that happening. Well, practically impossible. So,
yeah, that seems very optimistic.
Yeah, I just really, really like hearing that, Jerry, because we've had a sort of an issue over here where we've created something. And we've been having conversations around Pot Follows member to remove the large number of small schemes that could potentially be there. And now there are conversations around Pot for Life, which mainly have come around from government and people that are seeing nice little bits of the Australian model. But you're actually creating something where that would work. Whereas here, we'd have to rip up effectively 12 years of auto-enrollment legislation and start again to give us Pot for Life. So it's encouraging that you're actually starting with that.
Yeah, no, I think, like I said, I think it has its merits. So it has its downside a little bit as well, in that you've got an existing system which is running side by side. And I think auto-enrollment has been designed with the idea that there's a whole load of people who are working for employers, don't have pension plans in place, they'll be auto-enrolled, they stay there forever. Whereas in reality, there will be interaction with the other side of the system where people move between different types of jobs or whatever. The way auto-enrollment is certainly designed to start is that you can transfer in and out. You can only retire at state pension age. Again, a lot of that makes sense from a starting position. It may be that once the system's up and running, you start to look at how you can do those, add those other bits to it. But I can certainly see issues around, you know, somebody who's got a DC plan from one employer and then a bit of auto enrollment. They come to retire, how you work out what your revenue limits are when you've had tax relief in one and not in another, you know, stuff like that. But to be honest, sometimes I think we can get really caught up in dealing with all those outlier issues rather than kind of figuring out, well, it's going to work fine for most people. Let's not worry about the, you know, the obscure cases that we will all have to deal with eventually. But, you know, sometimes there's a bit of, you know, perfect being the enemy of good, and you just need to get it started and figure out things as you go along rather than trying to get it perfect before you hit the ground running. So
I think you're right. I'm kind of heartened to hear you talk about just building something that's good for most people and not worry too much about rich people who want to do stuff. Well, okay, we'll work out a system where you can transfer between the two. Maybe you do something with the top up or whatever you do, you can do. There are answers to all these kind of problems, but if you just want, if you want people to have bigger pots, well, I know Simon hates that word, bigger pensions at the time that they get to retirement and the time society wants them to move on to the next phase of their life, because that's the problem with this sort of, you know, we have the demographics in our countries, which I'm sure are similar in the sense that, you know, you've got people you need to work, be productive, but also you want them to stop and succession plan and everything else. Although I suppose maybe you want people to work a bit longer because we want people paying tax longer, because, you know, our demographics are both going the same way with lower immigration and birth rates and boomers taking everything and all the rest of it. It just feels such a hard problem to resolve.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, a couple of weeks ago, there was something on the national papers about people who've reached the standard fund thresholds that have reached their lifetime earnings limit, and basically have stopped contributing to schemes and are probably being paid cash instead, that those people will in theory be auto-enrolled. And you think, okay, so it's a couple of hundred people out of the 800,000 people who will be auto-enrolled. Does it really matter? You know, it's a first world problem. They'll have this tiny bit of pension they'll pay a lot of tax on, but there'll still be more pensions. So anyway, it's, yeah, I do think we can just get caught up with those issues sometimes rather than looking at what's the greater good here and just get on with it.
Are there some other, you know, sort of thinking about pensions policy, Simon and I talk about pensions policy quite a lot with those demographic challenges of moving from people with DB to people with purely DC. Have you started thinking about how people, I don't know what the rules are, get into my ignorance, I should have done a bit more research, Jerry, but, you know, when people get to their retirement with a DC pot of money, what are their options and how do you help them make decisions about what to do with that money at the end? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, probably not a surprise to hear we're not this magic country that's cracked that problem. I think we're a bit like everybody else. So I suppose like everyone else, we went from a situation where people just bought an annuity and that was it. I mean, sorry, you take your tax-free cash, you buy an annuity. So the system's quite similar that way. To then introducing a product called an approved retirement fund, which is basically a product you can continue to invest and draw down. But problem with that is people are moving from, you know, DC to an individual product. You need advice. People don't always get the best advice. People then have to try and manage their drawdowns over their lifetime, which is difficult, and can get even more difficult as people get older. So it's one of those issues that I think is being looked at quite a bit in terms of having in-scheme drawdown, for example. I think that's very much on the agenda, and I would expect that to come in the next year or so, so that at least you've got a more collective type of management of that with a set of trustees. You know, some employers do go a bit further and organise individual personal advice for people that they will pay for, but surprisingly, that isn't even always taken up by people. So yeah, I think that's a really difficult issue. Personally, you know, I like the sort of solutions that involve some sort of longevity insurance kicking in, even if it's just for, you know, asking people in their 80s or 90s to make difficult decisions about finance can be very difficult, particularly with cognitive issues that people might have. So having some sort of backstop there where you've got a drawdown, but you've got an insurance bit that kicks in towards the end, I think those types of solutions, I've seen some of the states doing that, that that would be good. But it's still early days. And even around auto enrollment, they've sort of left the drawdown piece, the retirement piece, because rationale is you're enrolling people up to the age of 60. They can't retire till 66. First people who get enrolled and retire will probably have very small amounts saved because the contribution rates will have been lower at the beginning. So they're probably just going to get everything in cash anyway. So it's not something we need when the system starts. It's probably a few years in, so we can take a bit more time to think about it.
And just looking across Europe, Jerry, do you think there are any countries that have really got their head around the demographic changes and are sort of where we should be looking, either Ireland or the UK should be looking to get inspiration from?
I think the, I mean, you've got the obvious ones, you know, the countries that always come top of the table in terms of pension systems. So Netherlands, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Scandinavian countries particularly. I mean, those countries have been sort of funding retirement for a long time. And sometimes that's the difference, where a lot of other countries, ourselves included, rely a lot on pay-as-you-go models. And, you know, with demographic aging, pay-as-you-go starts to look very unsustainable. So that's a challenge for other countries. But I think those countries have been funding for a long time. But even then, they're not without their challenges either. I mean, you know, if you look at the Netherlands, it's planning to undergo a huge transformation from effectively DB, a form of DB to a form of DC. You know, that's been driven by some of those issues as well. So, yeah, I think it's difficult for everyone, but I do think those countries that have kind of grasped the nettle quite a long time ago are obviously in a better place. And, you know, obviously, naturally, they would be.
Yeah, there's no magic answer, really. Again, you alluded to it earlier. There's no magic answer. You've got, if you're bigger pensions, you have to put more money in and work longer. Yeah, that is, unfortunately, the answer.
Yeah, it is that bit, save more, raise taxes, or work longer. And, you know, God help any politician who makes that their platform message.
Well, I suppose they tend to go for the fourth option, which I haven't mentioned, is boost those investment returns and invest in what, you know, we have coined the term over here, productive finance, which it's just making us roll our eyes a little bit. Been an exasperated topic again for the last nearly a year since Mansion House in July. Have your policymakers got their eyes on?
I mean, certainly it's come up in the context of auto enrollment. A lot of the kind of political stuff around it has been, where is this money going to be invested? It should be invested in Ireland. It should be invested in the Irish economy. I mean, you've seen in the past, when you've got a very small economy, if you're overinvested in it, you suffer on the double when things go south. You know, most Irish pension funds now would be invested globally, very diversely, and that's the way it should be. So that's always a difficulty. Seen quite a bit of that in Europe at the moment as well. There's a lot of focus on the capital markets union and the need for more investment in the European economy. And, you know, that's right. I sort of always worry about those discussions, because I think quite often politicians just see pension funds as a lot of money and a lot of money that's there to be invested. And it's like, how can we get our hands on it? And sort of forgetting that, yeah, it's a lot of money, but it's made up of the savings of a lot of people and their retirement savings that are really important to them. But I do think there are ways in which you can bring those two things together, where, you know, pension funds do want to invest and they do want to get good returns. And if that's in the European economy or the British economy or whatever, as long as there's a good investment case there for it, but there has to be a good investment case there for it. But I do think you can bring those two things together and have discussions around. I mean, certainly during the financial crisis in Ireland, we had discussions with our National Treasury Management Agency, who managed the national debt, about the types of bonds that would be attractive to pension funds, because the Irish government, as pretty much a rule, only ever issued bonds up to about 10 years in duration, rarely issued any index-linked bonds. But they were happy to issue some of those because they needed the money, and pension funds said they were the kind of things they'd be interested in investing in. So I think you can bring those things together, but it is important you do, rather than just almost pressurizing people to invest in things they really don't want to invest in.
Yeah, your point on the double hit, Jerry, is really important. I was just looking at some stats from the Central Bank of Ireland. And to give our listeners an idea, the Netherlands pension funds assets as a percentage of their GDP is 215%. It's an enormous amount. As a comparison, Ireland, they said, was 34% of GDP. And Germany was 17%, just to give some comparators there. But yeah, I mean, if you're taking the bulk of that money and investing it in one place, albeit in sort of the home country, as it were, if there is a downturn, then yeah, exactly, the pension and the country takes a hit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that will, you know, that Dutch example gives you, you know, when you think the bulk of the, you know, the two biggest pension funds in the Netherlands are made up of the pension investments of the education sector and the health sector, which in many countries are pay-as-you-go systems. So, you know, there's the same scale of liability there without the actual investments. So that's, you know, that's the issue. But no, absolutely. And I think, you know, the Dutch ones would be at the forefront of that. You know, we need to be invested in a very diversified way because that's what works for our pensioners in the future.
Yeah, that's the problem with the UK, is we're getting this obsession with value for money, but moving away from costs, because we've got charge caps, these kind of things, and to allow productive finance, you're kind of weakening that and then just saying, oh, value is a bit more of a woolier concept. It's a slightly more value judgment rather than an objective statement, and that worries me as well. That kind of the termite effect of higher charges with no guarantee of higher returns just seems such an odd direction to force everyone to go in, and then you're asking schemes to disclose what they're investing in, hoping they'll tell you they're investing in British businesses. But when the MSCI does 200% and the UK does 60, you know, where are they going to be investing? Yeah. Well, they're not going to be investing in the UK. That's ridiculous. You know, it's such a depressing conversation sometimes. You kind of want to just shake people.
Yeah, and, you know, that focus on value is, it's always really difficult. And I think it quite often leads to people just looking at cost, because at least cost is cost, whereas value is a bit more, it's a bit woolier in terms of, yeah, we think we're getting value. And you're right, I think there is almost this assumption that the higher cost you pay, the more value you're going to get. And, you know, higher cost means higher returns, but that's not always the case. And quite frequently, actually, that's not the case. So, you know, you really have to drill into it to be sure, and then to kind of follow your beliefs on it.
You've also got to have alignment between government and the regulator, because we have a regulator that's been saying for many years, de-risk at all costs, buyout is the gold standard. And now we're being told by government, well, actually, we want to look at run-on, which is not something really that the regulator was I'd say, particularly keen on. So, yeah, we've got a real interesting conversation at the moment over here, Jerry.
Yeah, and I think those conversations are very similar elsewhere as well, because, you know, regulators will quite rightly say they're here to regulate. You know, the government's agenda and what the government would like pension funds to invest in is fine, but, you know, they've got to make sure that those investments are secure and safe, and that people ultimately will get the pensions they should expect to get. Yeah, it can be difficult determining, you know, what's the national interest, and politicians will have a different view of that than regulators will.
Another question I probably should have done some research for, Google will probably tell me. Another thing that comes up a lot is about having some sort of retirement commission in the UK to sort of set policy for the long term and make sure that politicians can't fiddle with things and like, our, you know, like our step ups in auto enrollment contributions has been delayed, and, you know, it looks like it'll be delayed to the latter half of this decade now. How do you do that in Ireland, just out of interest?
Yeah, we're the same. I mean, we would prefer if there was something like that in place rather than relying on political will or whatever the, you know, the kind of public sector agenda is in terms of what you can get civil service interest in. Although I'm never convinced that having that sort of retirement commission in place will lead to what you think it will lead, because politicians can just ignore it ultimately anyway. So unless they have some sort of overriding powers, which are never going to be given, then Yeah, I think it's better because it's harder to ignore, but I've seen too many cases where, you know, reports are done and they're just shelved and everybody forgets about it and moves on.
It's always my point on it, Jerry, because the politicians will set up the commission. They'll set the terms of the commission because we want you to look at this one specific problem. They just say, go and have a free run at it and tell us what you think. It's have a look at this one problem, which the government already knows the answer to anyway. And as I think Dave has said before, is when you've got something unpleasant to tell people, get an independent commission to say it. And then you go, look, it was them. It wasn't us. we're just doing what they told us. And if it's a popular thing, they say, well, yes, we brought the commission in because we knew that the answer was going to be this. Yeah, I'm not a fan generally, but you could probably tell that.
Yeah, for our listener, there was some violent nodding from Simon Ayers. But Jerry was sounding a bit too keen on commissions at first. And I was thinking, oh, no, I'm going to have to tell him that we don't like commissions on this podcast. But then he was...
He came back around
and it was brilliant.
Yeah, pulled it out of the bag. Well, we probably should bring this to a close at some point, Jerry, as enjoyable as this is. Before we do, can we just look to dashboards? Because it's another thing we're particularly exercised with in the UK at the moment. And it's that they're coming, but they're not here yet. Could you give us an overview of where you are in Ireland and again, what you've seen across Europe?
Yeah, it's not really on the Irish agenda, which somewhat surprises me because I would have thought auto-enrollment would be a good point to look at it. You know, if you're bringing in a new system, you can sort of start it off. I've always thought looking at far at the UK that sometimes, and it's back to this idea of perfection, I think you're just better off starting from the future. You know, we're going to do things for the future that will be, you know, easy to put into a dashboard, but trying to get every legacy pension from the past into something, I can understand why it's taken so long and how difficult that is. I think dashboards are hugely important. I think they're really allowing people to be able to pull all their stuff together quickly is really important. I actually did something myself recently, and like I've only had five jobs. First one, which was with an insurance company, but I was young, so I could leave and get a refund of contributions, which was great. So I was able to pay off my credit card debt. That was my priority at the time. And then I went and I worked in the UK. Then I came back. I worked in the public sector here. Now I'm working with the IPF. So I don't have the widest array of pensions in the world, but I did spend a bit of time a couple of weeks ago kind of pulling it all together because I'm getting to that age where it's now thinking, oh yeah, it's on the horizon. So it took me so long. Like, you know, my UK, I had a contracted out money purchase scheme that's on one platform. My DB scheme is on another platform. I think I was registered with one, but I had to register with another and get some ID together and do all that. The DB one told me how much pension I would get at my retirement age, but didn't tell me what that was, even though I did know it. PC one is obviously very straightforward. My public sector in Ireland, I had the letter that told me how many years of pensionable service I had. I then had to go and look up what the current salary is for the grade when I left, and then multiply that and divide by 80. And because now I think somebody did tell me since there is something online, I could have done that a little bit easier. But for, you know, for somebody who's quite knowledgeable about all of this, it still took me 2 or 3 hours just to get to that starting point. And then you add in the complexity of state pensions in both countries. And yeah, it's just not straightforward. So I think having something that somebody can log in and just, you know, an overview of what they have is absolutely essential. And particularly, you know, when people are working, having more jobs and more jobs that are likely to get a pension out of as well, you know, with things like auto-enrollment. So I think they're really important. I think the countries they work well in, they seem to work really well. Like I've seen examples from people, I think it was a Swedish example, you know, put in the equivalent of the national insurance number and it pulled in all their pensions, what date they were payable from, what they were projected to be at that date. The data didn't sit anywhere, it just disappeared back, you know, it was just pulled in for that moment. But I would say that in those countries, everything tends to be online from date of birth. So, you know, I think if that's not the norm, then it's hard to create it. But I do think in the future we do need to work off that, so that, you know, just getting that overview is really important so people can get a better sense of where they are, rather than, you know, what we alluded to earlier, people just thinking, well, I have a pension, so I'm fine. You know, and it's, you know, a tiny auto-enrollment pension or, you know, whatever. You know, yes, you have a pension, but you're not fine. I think it's important for people to know that sometimes.
Well, I was quite excited though earlier when you were talking about using the revenue to help with auto-enrollment, because we, HMRC over here, they're no help whatsoever. So it feels like you might be a step ahead from that, because that was a proposed solution as well for Dashboard, just to get the revenue to start being the conduit for all this data. I mean, there's loads of data flying through them. Why can't they do it? And they were just like, no way. I don't know if the Irish tax office is better.
Yeah, I think in fairness to the revenue in Ireland, I think, you know, in the early days of auto-enrollment, they sort of flagged that, you know, it would be difficult, it would take a lot of resource, they didn't really want to do it, but if they were told to do it, they would do it. So, and, you know, they do get reused for a lot of things because they do actually have a really good system. You know, they've got, you know, pretty much live, absolutely up to date, earnings data, tax data. So, yeah, it's there. So I think using it makes absolute sense. So, yeah.
Well, Jerry, that's been really interesting and absolutely fascinating. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. It's an absolute pleasure.
And thank you to all of our listeners for listening. Don't forget you can subscribe to the broadcast through your favourite podcast provider, and you can catch up on our previous episodes by looking at our Broadstone broadcast webpage. But for another episode of the broadcast, we want to thank you all, and we'll see you next time.